we are at a point where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is ready to start discussing the sin of the golden calf. That's really, you know, where we're up to in this whole discussion of in the first essay. It's on page 105, where the Kuzari says, okay, after you've already told me all of these amazing experiences about the Jewish people, that they're the chosen nation, that they're... We started off by saying that the Jewish people represent the fifth level of creation. They're superior, they're superhuman. And look at all of the experiences that they had, the revelatory experience at Har Sinai, all of this amazing stuff. But then the Kuzari said, you know, there's a certain incredulity that he has, because how then could you tell me that after this revelation that they had at Har Sinai, and of their loftiness as a people, their prophetic abilities, how then could it be that they could fall so quickly and so entirely with the sin of the golden calf? That's the question. So the first response is what we're going to read today, which is at the bottom of page 105, paragraph 93. And you have to be the judge. You're here now as the judges to determine whether Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is at this point going to be engaging in apologetics, or whether he's actually giving a legitimate argument in defense of the displaced faith, in defense of Klal Yisrael. So let's take a look at the bottom where it says, the rabbi said the severity. Who's going to be our reader today? Any volunteers? Okay, go ahead.
The rabbi said the severity of their sin was magnified because of their greatness. Great indeed is one whose sins are enumerated.
All right, so that's the first defense. First of all, we have to appreciate that when the Tanakh records the sins of the Jewish people, it tends to exaggerate the sins of Klal Yisrael. And this is the first point that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi makes, is that, and we have this concept, HaKadosh Baruch Hu medakdek im chasidav kechut ha-sa'ara, that God is more meticulous with his pious ones to a hair's breadth. That means that Hashem will be more harsh with righteous people than he is with people who don't possess that kind of righteousness. When we have a child who we hold in high, high regard as being our A student, our overachiever. So when that child comes home with a B, so, you know, we give it to him. If you're either Chinese or Jewish, you give it to him, right? So what, a B? B, what are you doing just coming home with a B? I expected a higher mark. But when a child is not an overachiever, when a child is an average student, so then when they come home with a B, it's a big simcha. It's a time for rejoicing. So the first thing is that when we find the Tanakh being critical of the Jewish people, we have to appreciate that because they are so great, the Torah magnifies their sin. And that is something that is consistent throughout the words of our sages, and it's something that the Ibn Ezra says, and it's something that the Gemara says as well. The second thing that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says over here is, great indeed is one whose sins are enumerated. And I think that not only is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi referring to, in general, a person who we can enumerate their sins, because like they say about the Vilna Gaon, that he used to have a little notebook by his bedside, and that every day he would mark down how many seconds he had wasted in the day. Now, if a person could do that, first of all, it's a worthwhile endeavor. Can you imagine having a little diary or a journal on your bedside, and at the end of every day you think about everything that you did over the day and say, how many averas did I do today? Could you think, and then at the end of the year, right before Rosh Hashanah, you go back and look at the ledger, and it tells you sort of a journal of what I have to do tshuva for over the next 10 days. Now that would be, if a person can do that, that would be incredible. Can you imagine the significance and the impact of that kind of experience, of that kind of life that you would have, a life that's filled with meaning, where you actually can review the events of your life in a truly meaningful and scrutinizing fashion. The Vilna Gaon used to be able to mark down how many seconds a day he had wasted. Now, of course, that's angelic, but at least for us, we can try to go over, just to review in our minds, just take a few seconds every day to review in our minds what we've done over the course of the day, write down our regrets, and then go to bed. That would be a wonderful thing. So great indeed is a person who can enumerate in a small list all the things that they've done. And that, he says, is in itself a great thing about the Jewish people, that we can talk about the very specific infractions that Klal Yisrael committed when they were traveling through the Midbar, but realize that those were the only things they did wrong. This was not a daily routine, even though sometimes you get the impression, because you read a story that is compacted over a 40-year journey in the desert, is compacted over a few chapters in the Chumash, you get the impression that it's just one sin after the other. But what we neglect to realize is that the Torah is only extracting a few days worth of those 40 years and highlighting and accentuating the specific times in which they committed averus, which means that all the other times during the 40 years they were fine, they were righteous, they were submissive, they committed to learning and to the mitzvahs and so forth. I also think that perhaps what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is alluding to here is the uniqueness of our holy scriptures, is the uniqueness of the Torah. Because it's very rare to find this in other holy scriptures, where there is a narrative that relates the sins of the chosen people. You don't find a narrative in the New Testament to the same degree of highlighting the infractions of the great apostles. You don't find the narrative in the Quran, to the limited extent of my exposure to the Quran, which highlights the infractions of Muhammad or his disciples. So the very fact that the Torah is unique in that respect is that it spends so much time highlighting the sins of the people, it means that we're not trying to hide anything here. This is not a polemic to defend the cause of Judaism. It's to teach us. It's a teaching tool to teach us how it is possible for even a holy people to fall from grace, and therefore we should learn from our history. That's the function of the Chumash, and that I think is what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is alluding to over here. So, let's turn the page, page 106. Now, as we're going to see in just a moment, we're going to be changing subjects and going into a major interlude before we get into the specific narrative of the golden calf, the Egel Hazor. So let's see. We're gonna get there in a circuitous fashion. So we have a big introduction that the rabbi has to make before he gets into the actual story of the golden calf. But the Kuzari puts down another challenge in paragraph 94. Please go ahead, Rachel.
The Kuzari says, "You say this only out of your favorable bias toward your people. What great sin is there then? Idolatry. What greatness could possibly remain after that? After that?"
That seems to be the worst. The worst of Klal Yisrael is idolatry, a complete rejection of Hashem. So there's an assumption that's being made here that the Egel HaZahav is an act of idolatry. It seems that way because the Jewish people fashioned for themselves a graven image, and that in itself is one of the definitions of idolatry. As we will soon discover, for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, this was not a forsaking of Hashem, this act of worshiping the golden calf, but was rather a means whereby they felt they could better serve God. And that's going to be the way that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to approach the Chet HaEgel. But we're not going to get there for another couple of weeks. Yes?
To me, it's interesting that not only does the Torah record the sins of the people in it, but it records the sins as if they had been done in a much worse way than they actually did it. So let's say in your example, if your son usually gets A, he comes home with a B, it's like the Torah wouldn't even say he got a B, the Torah would say he failed. And we see that so many places, let's say with Reuven moving his father's bed, his mother's bed, you know, to his father, David and Bathsheba, Yosef. Like, so many times you read things that people did, and it's written as if they did something so much worse than they did.
It's an excellent point. The reason why I equivocate a little bit about that is because the whole notion that the Torah over-accentuates the sins of Klal Yisrael requires one to accept what you are, the premise that you are suggesting, which is what Chazal say, and that is that the Torah tends to exaggerate the sin and not just accentuate it. So the perfect examples that you gave, is one example is this, when the Torah says that Reuven slept with Bilhah, it doesn't literally mean that. It means that he switched his mother's bed, he moved his father's bed into Leah's tent, whereas Yaakov had moved it into Bilhah's tent. And this was considered to be a bilbul yitzu'ei aviv, the confusion of his father's couch was not really a sin that Reuven committed of being with his father's wife. Chazal say that, but the psukim don't say that. So yes, it's true, Chazal's tradition is that the Torah exaggerates the sin when there really was none. Or the Gemara which says, Chol HaOmer, Shadavid Chata Eino Elatoe. Anyone who says that King David sinned is really making a mistake. Now, what the Gemara does is it says that King David was not guilty of adultery, but it doesn't mean that he didn't sin at all, it just means that he wasn't guilty of adultery because technically she was an unmarried woman at the time that David spent the night with her. And yet, the psukim seem to certainly indicate that he did something quite criminal. There is an equivocation here among the Meforshim, whether Chazal are to be taken literally or whether they're not to be taken literally. For example, the Abarbanel, on that story of David and Bathsheba, disagrees with the Gemara. And he says that the author of that statement was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And because Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was a descendant of David HaMelech, he wanted to whitewash the sin in order to amplify the stature and the prestige of the house of David. So that's true. But I think that your point that you're making is a very extremely valid point. Chazal had a tradition that not only does the Torah accentuate the sin, but it even exaggerates the sin. This is one view in Chazal, but again, it's something that one can either choose or choose to subscribe to or choose not to subscribe to.
But I wonder why. I mean, the only thing I can think of is that Hashem kind of wants to force us to use Torah Shabbat Sav with Torah Shabbat Peh. But if you're only reading the Torah Shabbat Sav, then why paint them in a worse light than it really was? Even if you say that Hashem Medafik and Tzadik and Kachar Hasara, it would have been bad enough what they really did based on their level. So why magnify it?
That's a good question. One reason that the Torah may choose to magnify it is to show that even people who do really bad things have a place at God's table. That could be one of the reasons, is that, you know what, I will never reach the level of the Avos. None of us will ever reach the level of the Avos. And despite I may have done terrible things in my lifetime, but I'm redeemable. There's always the possibility of redemption is always possible. If Reuven has redemption, and redemption is possible for Reuven after having done that terrible Avera, or if there's redemption possible for David HaMelech after having sinned with Bathsheba, not just taking Bathsheba, but also causing Uriah to be killed and committing adultery, so then there's redemption for everyone. That could be one of the reasons. Okay, so what greatness could possibly remain? That's the question. What greatness could possibly remain in the Jewish people after they sin with the Egel HaZahav? So here's our interlude, and let's take a look. Go ahead, Rachel. Paragraph 95.
The rabbi said bear with me until I have explained to you the greatness of this nation. I have proof enough of their greatness from the fact that God chose them from among all other nations to become his people. God rested his divinity upon them, so much so that all of them heard God's words. This divinity passed over to the Jewish women as well, who also became prophets. And this is in contrast to the fact that from Adam up until then, divinity had settled only on a few selected individuals.
So the idea of prophecy passing over to the Jewish people means that prophecy passed over to them en masse because of the divine revelation upon the exodus from Egypt. And it even went on to the women. Surprise, surprise. Right? In other words, this is, of course, using the medieval conception that women are more closely related to the physical world, and therefore it would be harder for them to be able to grasp or to be able to relate to transcendent concepts and transcendent experiences. But the fact that prophecy was able to rest on the women is even a greater display of the holiness and the transcendence of the entire nation. And of course, he's referring to the fact that Ra'as HaShivcha Al Hayam, that a handmaid that was witness to the spectacle of the splitting of the Red Sea, saw more than Yechezkel ben Buzi, saw more than the vision of the chariot that the prophet Ezekiel was able to witness. The revelation of Hashem, it says, Vayari Yisrael as Hayad HaGidolah, that the Jewish people saw the great arm of Hashem, the great hand of Hashem, and that was something that was more overt and more apparent even to the unlettered and to the unprepared for prophecy, even more so than later generations. So this was, and what is unique about this experience is that up until God reveals himself to the Jewish people at the time of the Exodus and at Matan Torah, prophecy, the prophetic experience of interfacing between man and God, is only given to select individuals up until that time. Now, I want you to think about this question as we read the next couple of pages. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to be talking about the chosenness of the Jewish people. And you know that famous poem, How Odd of God to Choose the Jews. Why did God choose us? Why did Hashem choose the Jewish people? Did God choose the Jewish people because of some merit? Because we were better than everybody else? Did God choose us because of some innate genetic quality that we possessed? Which one is it? What caused God to choose the Jewish people and to make us into his nation? Before you answer the question, we need to look at the text and think about it. There's going to be a difficulty in either way that you answer this question, but if you look at the text of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, you're going to discover that it's very confusing. Because Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to give us the impression that our chosenness stems from Adam, and we just happen to be the genetic inheritors of something special within Adam HaRishon. We're not going to see anything in the chosenness of the Jewish people that is related to righteous acts of our patriarchs. I just want you to keep that in mind. And then after we read the text, if you want to be able to suggest an idea about how you understand this, then you'll let me know. Terry, did you want to say something? Or you want to wait?
If you make a comment, because I wasn't getting the right
answer. All right, okay. All right, let's go on. Paragraph number 2 in paragraph 95.
Adam himself was completely without flaw. There can be no doubt that this was so because he was made by an unnamed omniscient artisan who chose what ingredients to use and what form he would take. There was no deficiency that one would find in a regular human attributable to the father's semen or mother's blood. There was likewise no deficiency attributed to food or behavior during the childhood years. Nor was there any deficiency in Adam's environment, air, water, and land. For God created Adam as an adult in his physical and emotional prime. Adam's soul and intellect were likewise the maximum human potential. Moreover, Adam achieved the level above intellect called the divine force. Well, by simply thinking the individual attaches himself to God and to a celestial being and comprehends the truth of all things without having previously studied them. His great stature gained for himself and all those early descendants who resembled him as the title Son of God.
Right, there's a lot of information here in this paragraph. The first thing that he says is that Adam HaRishon was physically superior to all human beings that ever lived after him. So there's a famous question: if every human being who ever lived walked past you, how would you be able, without their clothes on, how would you be able to tell which ones were Adam and Eve? And the answer, of course, is they'd have no belly button, right? Because you only get a belly button when you're born. Adam and Chava were created as adults. Now, of course, I don't believe that. I think that when Hashem creates human beings, He created Adam and Chava b'tzelem Elokim, because we all are tzelem Elokim. Adam and Chava were created with belly buttons anyway, even though they didn't need one. But the point is that we all are genetically flawed in some way. We're genetically flawed because we come from a mother and a father who contribute to our genetic pattern, our genetic makeup. Adam and Chava had no genetic flaws. They were the perfect human beings. Now this is besides the whole discussion in the mystical literature that comes after Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, which talks about the fact that when Adam and Chava were created, they were created as really supernatural beings whose bodies were really more like ethereal substance until they sinned by eating of the tree. So we won't go into that now, but we're just from a simple understanding of genetics, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is saying, imagine the very first human beings have no genetic flaws whatsoever. Normally, he says that every human being is a product of the father's semen and the mother's blood. This is medieval science. The Ramban says this point as well, that there are different levels of pigmentation within every human being. There are certain parts of our bodies that are white, and certain parts of our bodies that have deeper colors like red or black, like hair or the pupil of the eye. And then there's parts of our bodies that are white that are like bone or like the white of the eye. He says that's any part of the body that is pigmented is from the mother's blood, and any part of the body that is non-pigmented is from the father's fluids. That's the way that medieval science, that's the way that biology and genetics was understood back in those times. And that's what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is describing. We, of course, have a different way of describing it, but it's essentially boils down to the same thing, that we're a product of the genetic material that is put together by our mother and our father. And furthermore, a lot of our physical flaws are a product of our, not only of our nature, but also of our nurture. That we are brought up in environments which cause us to get freckles because we're exposed to too much sunlight, and that's what they tell you, is that everyone's skin is damaged because we've spent time out in the sun. We've been damaged by food that we've ingested, a lot of the junk food and a lot of the other chazarai that we eat that's in our environment damages and causes our bodies to break down in certain ways. The air quality, the land quality, the way that we play sports, all of these things cause our bodies to become compromised in some way. And this, none of this existed when Adam HaRishon was created as an adult. His body was perfect. And that's the first point. The first point is he is the embodiment of physical perfection. And now point number two is he's the embodiment of spiritual perfection as well. And because his neshama is a direct product of Hashem's creation, his spiritual essence represents the purest form that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can give to a human being. And therefore what he describes is a kind of person that is described in philosophical texts who can attach himself to the active intellect. Remember, we talked about that term before. He can attach himself to divinity. Adam HaRishon had this uncanny ability to converse with God at any time. Remember, I mentioned to you, we talked about last week when we talked about the Dvar Torah, about the Keruvim, we mentioned that the Gan Eden had a ubiquity of divinity spreading out throughout it. There was no isolated point where you had to go to in order to achieve connection to the divine. to Hashem. Wherever you were in the garden, you just were there. Hashem was there with you. And this, this was the level that Adam HaRishon had at that time. And part of that was not just because he was deposited in the garden, but because his soul had that level of connection. And he compromised his soul when he ate from the Eitz HaDaas. But in any event, you understand how Adam is capable of this greatness, and so that anyone who is going to be descended from Adam will retain that, that original kind of greatness. Over the course of several generations, there will be mutations that occur as a result of physical factors. There will be a number of degradations and compromises to this perfection of Adam over the course of many generations of reproduction. But the basic thesis is that the closer that you are generationally to Adam or Adam and Chava, the more perfect of a being you are, the more perfect of a human specimen you are. And it's only as we go through succeeding generations that the human being begins to erode further and further and further. It's almost the opposite of evolution, right? It's devolution. That human beings devolve as we get further and further away from the most perfect of human beings who was ever created, Adam and Chava. Yes?
But Adam's son Cain was a murderer, and he wasn't a very good person. So you see, one generation later already, you have a pretty evil person.
Ah, yes, so that's an interesting question. So who was Cain's father? Was it true? Was it really Adam? It seems that way from the text.
Cain and Hevel's yes. Brother.
Right. So who else could have sired Cain? The Zohar says that his father was the Nachash. But anyway, but even without that, right? There was obviously something that was introduced, even after the first generation. Or Cain himself was an exceptionally perfected human being, with this particular human flaw of not realizing intuitively that murder was wrong. You know, there was never a command yet. No one had been commanded of thou shalt not murder.
He knew there was something wrong because when God was talking to him, you know, where's your brother? You know, hold the me'afifa. Where's your brother? He kind of said, I think he kind of knew that he did something wrong.
Yeah.
God said, "Call to me Achifa, so I came and lined him up."
But there's a certain innocence even within that guilt, right? Laws hadn't been written yet. Yes, so your point is very well taken. And even after the first generation, man is capable of horrible things. And yet at the same time, the human being as a specimen of perfection is at his highest level. The closer we get to Adam HaRishon. And despite that, people are capable of terrible evil. Okay. And then he talks about the sons of man. Who are the sons of man? Who is he referring to? No, in chapter 6 in Genesis, in Sefer Bereshit, it says, Vayiru b'nei ha-Elohim es b'nos ha-Adam ki tovos heina. It says that the sons of God saw the daughters of man, and behold, they were good. And they took for themselves wives from all of those that they chose for themselves. The words B'nei HaElohim, the sons of God, of course, as you can imagine, it's a very Christian-sounding term, right? But yet it's in our Torah. What does B'nei HaElohim mean? It means that they're called the sons of God because they have such a great resemblance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, because they're such a great a specimen of humanity. And since man is made in the image of God, they most closely resemble what God had in mind when he created man. That's the way Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi understands it. Now, of course, there's a much deeper explanation to this that Chazal have. About who these B'nei HaElohim are, because Chazal tell us that sometimes the greater one is, the more defiled they can become. Just to follow that theme of the Kayan discussion, Chazal tell us that these B'nai HaElohim actually were quite despicable in their behavior. Vayikhu lahem nashim mikol asher bacharu, they took for themselves wives, meaning that they engaged in, they forcibly took other people's wives, that women who were already married, even though they had accessible to them, they had single women, but they didafka took married women. And they also, mikol asher bacharu, from all that they chose, means that they engaged in homosexuality as well, and bestiality. In other words, they weren't satisfied with just taking that which was available to them in a normative marital experience, but they engaged in all different kinds of things that would be considered to be non-normative, because they had this insatiable appetite to experience every physical indulgence under the sun. And so the question is, who were these B'nai HaElohim, or B'nai HaElohim? There are two different ways of understanding the translation of what B'nai HaElohim means. It's either with a capital Aleph or a lowercase Aleph, you understand? And I say that tongue-in-cheek, because there's no capital letters, but the word Elohim means two things. It can mean the sons of princes, or sons of great people, or it can mean sons of God. And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi seems to understand that as sons of God, meaning that they resembled the greatness that was within Adam HaRishon the most, and yet they committed sins like this, because the reason for this narrative in the Torah is to describe to us how completely overpowering the Yetzer Hara was to early man. And how even truly great people who were specimens of perfection could become so debased because the physical desires of mankind were so much more overpowering than they are today. And this is sort of a narrative that acts as an introduction to the story of the flood in Parshas Noach, because this is a story that takes place at the end of Sefer Bereishis. And it's therefore acting almost as a defense for mankind before the flood, to tell us that because of the overpowering nature of physicality at the time, it's no surprise that man had descended into the lowest depths of humanity. And as a result, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to detach man somewhat from the physical world by wiping the slate clean and starting all over again. Mm-hmm. And that's what the flood represented. Okay? The Alshich HaKadosh brings down the mystical tradition that we find in various different writings. And he tells us that B'nai HaElohim means angels that were placed into human bodies. Now this, of course, is not at all what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is referring to, but to me it's one of the most fascinating narratives in all of Tanakh. The Medrash and other texts relate that the angels are described or depicted as being contemptuous of man. And as they say in Tehillim, Mo enosh kisis kerenu uven adam kisif gedenu. They say, what is man that you should be mindful of him? He is a puny being who will only rebel and cause you misery, O Hashem. This is what the angels proclaim about mankind, because they see a human being that is filled with opposite tensions. On the one hand, man has great potential for greatness, but on the other hand, he's filled with lust and physicality and a Yetzer Hara. So why, Hashem, should you pay so much attention to mankind? And this was the great criticism that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was hearing from the Malachim in the heavens during this period of time when mankind was descending into evil. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells the angels, according to our Midrashic and mystical tradition, that you have no right to criticize man because you are not aware of the challenges that he has to face on a daily basis. And therefore, in order to silence you angels, I will send you into this mortal world and you will see for yourselves what a Yetzer Hara is, what a physical nature is. And so B'nai HaElohim literally means that God took angelic beings who normally are not meant to occupy physical bodies and inserted them in physical bodies in order for them to experience what it means to have a physical side to yourself. See, normally a malach, the difference between a malach and a neshama is a neshama is meant to occupy a body. A malach is created, never meant to occupy a body. So that's why a malach doesn't even relate to or understand the challenges that human beings have to undergo. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes a certain core of malachim and inserts them into this world, sort of, you know, like in a movie where, you know, an angel comes down to this world and gets its wings clipped and now is part of this physical world, right? And now God says, okay, you're on your own. Let's see how you fare. And what the Torah tells us is that these malachim became even more corrupt in their physical indulgences than mankind had become. And this was the greatest defense for mankind, is that mankind was able to, despite all of the great temptations and physical yearnings and lusts that were pulling at man, they were still able to maintain at least a modicum of humanity and of goodness and of decency. Whereas these angels, who had been put into physical bodies, completely lost it. And that's why the Medrash says, "Vayichu lahem nashim mikol asher bacharu," they just went wild. And they just completely had no, without any borders or any restraints whatsoever. And this, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, is why I cannot destroy mankind completely, but this is why I have to start again, because there's mankind has redemptive value. There is value within the human being to be able to emerge despite the great evil that exists in the world. Mankind can still emerge from the darkness and still can show his greatness. And that's what I want the purpose of this project of this world to represent. And that's why this is the precursor to the story of the flood. So it's a fascinating subject. There's much more to discuss, but I want to go on to, we'll carry on this discussion later on, and we'll hold it here for now.